The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. This week in The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Kevin McCullough. Great to be with you. This week, after the ceasefire in Israel, we'll look at the challenge of being America's ally under President Biden.
If Trump was for it, we're against it.
We'll look at the grave threat from Boko Haram in Nigeria.
I've been talking to some people that are from Nigeria that have family there. They think this country is going to implode.
And a teacher in Loudoun County, Virginia, speaks candidly at a public hearing.
It's against my religion. It's lying to a child. It's abuse to a child. And it's sinning against our God.
After he was suspended, a local pastor speaks up.
I basically stood up in front of our congregation and I said, enough is enough. The school board is getting out of control. We can't even have one of our own members in our congregation express free speech.
We've got all this and more. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home station in New York City, where you can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on AM 570 and FM 102.3, The Mission. Take a moment to follow Christian Outlook on Twitter, at TC Outlook. You can also follow me on Parler and Instagram, at KMC Radio. Great to be with you. We'll start in Israel. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas seems to be holding, but the government in Israel may not be. The days of Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister may be numbered. For an update on Israel and the broader Middle East, I turn to KT McFarland, President Trump's first deputy national security advisor. She was a guest on my program in New York.
Okay, well, in our elections, what's supposed to happen is the majority of the people in the majority of the states elect a president. And what happens in Israel is nobody gets a majority for anything, no party. And they have, I forget how many, I mean, they probably have about 20-some parties, but really sort of three or four main parties, and they go from the far left to the far right. And so to be head of Israel, to be prime minister of Israel, a person needs to collect enough of those different smaller parties and pull together a coalition and then have the majority of support in their parliament. And that's a parliamentary system. That's what happens in Great Britain. But in Israel, it's always more complicated because as somebody once explained to me, you know, if you have two Israelis together, there are three opinions. And so the Israelis are constantly, the public debate is a very big thing in Israel. Everybody's very politicized. And so what you're seeing now is the thrashing around of the different parties sort of jockeying. I think a lot of the anti-Bibi stuff is not over policy as much as it's just, as you pointed out, he's been in office for more than a decade, and he was in office as prime minister several decades ago. So a lot of it is just sort of Bibi fatigue. But as far as I can sense, whether on the far left or the far right, and anybody in the middle, the attitude is pretty much the same. They want good relations with America. They want to pursue further the Abraham Accords with the Israelis and the Arab countries. And they're all pretty suspicious and skeptical and of one mind about what the Palestinians have been doing.
There's so much writing on the relationship between the U.S. And Israel and the rest of the region. And truly, the Abraham Accords are historic in terms of what they accomplished. They really, to some degree, neutralized the Palestinian debate in much of the Middle East dialogue. Have we seen regression on that front since the Biden administration has come in? And if so, what does that look like? And what do you think we need to do going forward?
You know, this is one of my biggest gripes with the Biden administration is they came into office and it was almost like they had this neuralgic response. If Trump did it, we don't want to do it. We're going to undo it. And so whether it was on the Mexican border, relations with China, relations with Iran, relations with Israel, if Trump was for it, we're against it. And so to go back to the Trump administration, we understood that in the Middle East, it was a sort of continuing cycle of violence. The Palestinians would lob some missiles, start a conflict with Israel. Israel would go into the Palestinian territories. They'd clean out the nests of where the missiles were being fired from. and then peace would ensue for a little bit of time, and then till the Palestinians got more missiles, and they started the whole cycle again. So we understood, well, how do we get to where we don't really support these guys anymore? And we realized that the corrupt Palestinian leaders were getting their funding and support from three places. One, the United States. The Arab countries, not to be confused with Iran, but the Gulf Arabs, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they were all supporting Palestinians too. So the third one was Iran, and Iran was supporting the same terrorist activities. So how do you sort of squeeze it out? Number one, we stopped supporting the Palestinian leaders because we knew the money was not going to the people. Number
right.
two, by the Abraham Accords that you mentioned, we got the Arab countries to lay down arms, and they made peace with Israel. And the side effect of that was the Arabs were no longer supporting the Palestinians. And then finally, by the sanctions on Iran crushing the Iranian economy, Iran was broke. They didn't have any extra resources to give to the Palestinians to make war. So what happens with Biden? He reverses all three of those things. We now give money to the Palestinians. He's against the Abraham Accords, and he's resumed relations with Iran. So predictably, what happened? The Palestinians got more missiles. They got them from Iran. They started lobbing them over against Israel. Here we are again, back in the good old bad days.
Israel's struggle for peace in the Middle East needs to be understood in the context of the broader struggle against radical Islam. ISIS may have been set back in Iraq and Syria, but the forces of radical Islam are a growing threat now in Africa. Boko Haram is one of the key terror groups. Frank Wolf is a former congressman from Virginia. He joined Don Crow on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
This is top of the list for importance right now, isn't it?
Well, it is. And thank you for covering the story, too, Don. I appreciate it very much. It is. It is. In fact, as if your listeners want to see, and maybe you have read, in Foreign Affairs magazine the other day, former Ambassador John Campbell, who you may know, he was the ambassador to Nigeria. He's currently with the Council of Foreign Relations. He did a column, an article, long article, saying basically Nigeria is a failed state. Now, when a former ambassador says that it's a failed state, and then he goes on to say that it's impacting on all of the other states in the so-called Lake Chad region, that's Burkina Faso. I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal today. The Wall Street Journal did a piece. 130 people were killed by jihadists in Burkina Faso. It's the big fact. The paper that's covering this best is the Wall Street Journal. But Cameroon, Chad, Ivory Coast,
yep.
Mali, Niger. So it is out of control. And what baffles me is the administration and frankly the Congress doesn't seem to be interested. You mentioned the word genocide. Genocide used to be a very powerful word that people would respond to, that Congress would respond to. Nobody's even talking about it. As you know, I think you've covered it once. Jihadists in Nigeria has killed more Christians than all the people that ISIS killed in Iraq and Syria combined, and nobody says anything about it.
And it's still ongoing. You're right. As we speak, as you probably, I'm sure you're aware, but just over the weekend, Nigeria has shut down the whole Twitter communications, and that's set off a whole new level of revolt and flaunting of the law. But Nigerians are angry. They're scared. And talk more to the point of the strategicness, especially of Nigeria. It is the biggest landmass state of any. It's certainly one of the wealthiest. It's been the most influential, would you agree, on the continent?
Well, absolutely. There are approximately 219 million people. In fact, it's in the year 2050. There will be more people in Nigeria than there will be in the United States. So, and it impacts on the entire West Africa. There's a saying out there that so goes Nigeria, so goes all of Africa, but certainly so goes West Africa. But it's and we do economic business. We give them a tremendous amount of foreign aid. There's a large diaspora, as you know. There are probably 400,000 to 500,000 Nigerian Americans living here. But it is unraveling. I want to be careful the words you say because you don't want to inflame it. I've been talking to some people that are from Nigeria that have family there. They think this country is going to implode. They think we'll literally implode. And you know, Europe has not done very well with the Iraqi Christians and Syria Christians coming in, about a million in Europe. 4 to 5 million will go into Europe and go into places beyond. And the Catholic Church is being persecuted. The Protestant Church is being persecuted. Muslims are being killed. It is just a critical thing. And yet, almost no one's covering it. Wall Street Journal, again, has done a good job. BBC has done a good job, but it's just not being covered. And for some reason, the administration is not really focusing on it.
How do you explain that, if you can? And also, I don't recall that really it even got the kind of attention that we would have hoped during the Trump administration, because this is not a recent story, sadly. It's been developing for years, as you know better than most of us.
Well, I agree. Now, to the credit of the Trump-Pence administration, they did designate Nigeria as a country of particular concern, which hits them in foreign aid and different things like this. But that came at the end of the administration, and so it really should have gone on earlier than that. But now this administration ought to pick up. There are two things you can be doing. I'm covering the hearings, so I won't go into detail. But we're asking that the administration appoint a special envoy. You remember when Sudan was unraveling, President George W. Bush picked former Senator John Danforth. Danforth did an amazing job. He brought about peace. He was able to negotiate for the West. He bring in our European allies, the French and the English, the UN, everybody. You need something like that. And also, we're recommending an idea. I don't know if you ever read any of Bob Kaplan's book. He has a brand new book out, which is an amazing, amazing book. It's called The Good American, The Epic Life of Bob Gersony. If you or your listeners go look at it, Bob Gersony, who is hailed as one of the greatest humanitarians, has now said he's willing to go to Nigeria and find out and come back to make some recommendations. So I just don't want to talk about how bad it is. It is so bad. I mean, the BBC coverage for the last several weeks is death almost every other day. Big death, 40, 50, 60, 70, 130. But I want to come up with some recommendations of what this administration can actually do to end it, to bring about an end to it. My hope is the two commissioners, good people. I mean, there are a lot of good people on there who care deeply, that they will embrace this issue, and they will constantly push the Biden administration, push Secretary Blinken to do some things. One, we need a special on board. We need to pick a good person that can come in, coordinate all the policies of our government, and deal with it. Secondly, we literally need to get the information out, and I think the Bob Gersony idea, I sent a letter to Samantha Power, head of AID, asking her to appoint Bob Gersony to do this. Bob Gersony lives here in Northern Virginia area. He has been willing to go and do this, which would be incredible. And if you read Robert Kaplan's book, you'll see the experience that he has. So to the credit of the commissioners, they are looking at this now and hopefully to come up with some recommendations. And they can single-handedly, if they make a commitment to do that, they can hit it over and over and over and over. Sometimes you hit it 5, 10, 15 times when the 15th time it breaks. By doing that, they can save thousands of lives. Thousands of people will die if the commission does not act.
Coming up, a school teacher speaks up against the radical gender ideology threatening his own district.
It's against my religion. It's lying to a child. It's abuse to a child. And it's sinning against our God.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. In community after community today, school boards and school superintendents are implementing new policies to advance critical race theory and the fast-evolving gender ideology. The latest front is Loudoun County, Virginia. Some of you may have seen this. Byron Tanner Cross is a Loudoun County schoolteacher. At a recent meeting of the school board, there was an opportunity for public comment. So Mr. Cross spoke up.
My name is Tanner Cross, and I'm speaking out of love for those who suffer with gender dysphoria. 60 Minutes this past Sunday interviewed over 30 young people who transitioned, but they felt led astray because lack of pushback or how easy it was to make physical changes to their bodies in just 3 months. They are now detransitioning. It's not my intention to hurt anyone, But there are certain truths that we must face when ready. We condemn school policies like 8040 and 8035 because it will damage children, defile the holy image of God. I love all of my students, but I will never lie to them regardless of the consequences. I'm a teacher, but I serve God first, and I will not affirm that a biological boy can be a girl and vice versa because it's against my religion, it's lying to a child, it's abuse to a child, and it's sinning against our God.
Subsequent to speaking up, Mr. Cross was suspended from his position. In addition to his suspension, he was prohibited from entering the school property and restricted from future dialogue at public comment sessions. Gary Hamrick is the senior pastor at Cornerstone Chapel in Leesburg, Virginia. Even prior to the episode with Byron Cross, they'd been tracking with the radical agenda of the school board. Hamrick joined Don Crow on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
Let's talk about how this all unfolded. Can you give us a little more of the backstory of Mr. Cross's experience and this school board meeting and how it ended up him losing his job?
Well, let me back up and give you a backstory. I was approached about 2 weeks ago by some parents and teachers who attend our church about a desire to recall several members of the Loudoun County School Board because of their liberal progressive policies that they are or are wanting to implement. And I hesitated at first to allow our church to be a place where signatures could be gathered to try to recall some of these school board members, just because I don't want a reputation as a church of just being against something. You know, I want the proclamation of the gospel about Jesus to go forth and people to get saved and to come in relationship with him. But I heard such an outcry that while I was deliberating, should we allow signatures to be gathered to recall some of these school board members, the case with Tanner came up, which was just that he goes to a public hearing that the school board invited public input. Okay, that's what this was. And as a Loudoun County public school teacher, he just has that First Amendment right to voice his opinion at a public meeting that was intended to gather public input. And he stated, and it's been all over the news across the country now, he basically stated that his Christian faith would really not allow him to affirm a gender of a student that was not consistent with God's design and their biology. And basically for that, because there's a policy right now, 8040, in front of the Loudoun County School Board that would require teachers to refer to a student by the pronoun that he or she chose as a student. Here's the pronoun I want to be referred to. That's the policy that is being debated. And so Tanner spoke out and said, my faith would not allow me to do that because I would be lying to them. So that's how all this started. And for that, he was placed on administrative leave.
We'll get back then to your call for the removal of some of those board members in a moment as well. But talk more your own convictions and that of so many in the church in leadership who are faced with this dilemma. I agree with you. Our primary calling is, in fact, to preach the gospel, bring men to Christ. But there's also this mandate to be salt. And I think that has a wide application, especially as we see so much of the culture's basic mores being totally compromised, if not totally reversed. What's your thought?
That's exactly right. There's a balance between proclamation and refutation. So we want to proclaim the good news of the gospel, but we need to refute policies or issues in our culture that are contrary to our values and our understanding of truth as it is revealed in Scripture. And when God says in Genesis 1:27 that he's created male and female in his image, there are only two genders. And when we start to indoctrinate people with the idea that there are multiple genders and they can decide to be whatever they want, I mean, that's just going against God's design. We want to affirm the beauty of God's design as he's created male and female, and anything beyond that is not being genuine to the truth. And so, yes, we need to refute some of these policies, especially transgender ideology that is indoctrinating children. You know, children cannot drink alcohol, they cannot vote, they cannot drive a car, but yet we're going to tell them that they can make life-altering decisions and even physically altering decisions at a young age just because somehow we are going to embrace multiple pronouns for their gender selection. It's contrary to truth, it's contrary to reality, it is contrary to biology, and it is contrary to God's design.
I know you've gotten cultural kickback, at least from some quarters politically and perhaps well, not so much demographically, but certain political views and so forth. We'll get to that in a moment. But what has the reaction been within your church? It's a large congregation, as we've already said, several thousand members. And I can't believe it was all unanimous in support, although I hope it was. What kind of feedback in-house have you gotten?
Don, I was amazed when I basically stood up in front of our congregation and I said, enough is enough. The school board is getting out of control. We can't even have one of our own members in our congregation express free speech and express his Christian faith without being censured like this. I said, enough is enough. And I said, if you want to recall the school board members, we've got petitions in the atrium. You don't have to if you don't want to. But Don, in every service, thousands of people stood to their feet applauding. Now, you know, that's probably not 100%, but I'm telling you, the outpouring of support I've gotten from across the country with emails as this story has gone national has been incredibly wonderful. And let me just add this, not even our congregation, our community and people who don't even profess to know Jesus as a Christian, they're on board with us too.
This is really one of those cases in which we're going to have to stand up and step up in ways that perhaps the American church has not had to do so in the past. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think we must. The hour demands it, because if we remain silent, who is going to be speaking the truth and speaking the truth in love? But even when you try to tell the truth as lovingly as possible, it will still be offensive to some, because truth by itself can be offensive.
What have you gotten in terms of negative feedback from the community at large and maybe some of other persuasions on the issue who feel you're out of line, number one, for even speaking out on it, number two, doing so from your pulpit? What kind of feedback or input or reaction have you gotten in that regard?
Loudoun County Democrats have put together a statement. They sent it out across the country, just basically asking me to recant my statements. People on our social media page trying to tell us about separation of church and state, which is just a fallacy, because that phrase does not exist in the Constitution, Bill of Rights, or anywhere in our founding documents. And so I'm not going to recant. We have to tell the truth, as I said, and we have to tell the truth in love. But this is about the First Amendment right of freedom of speech and freedom of worship to express our faith. And if Christians are going to be silenced, then who is going to be the salt and light in our community and in our culture and in our country? And so that's really what this is about.
Let me leave you with an update on this story. After his suspension, Byron Cross pursued legal representation from our friends at Alliance Defending Freedom. A judge has ordered that he be reinstated to his job. It's a temporary win as the case awaits trial, but an important one. Coming up, a better way to read the Bible.
You've been conditioned to read the Bible in one really specific way.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Kevin McCullough. The Bible. Many, perhaps most of you, have a desire to read it. But having a desire to read it and actually reading it faithfully are two different things. One thing that will help us is if we read each book of the Bible and interpret it according to its literary type. Matthew Mullins is the author of Enjoying the Bible, Literary Approaches to Loving the Scriptures. He was a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons on WORD 101.5 FM in Pittsburgh.
There's got to be millions and millions of people around the world who don't have the occasion to dive deep into it. It became, you know, sort of, it became like a gate around it, something that was maybe not forbidden, but verboten and mysterious. We've done ourselves a great disservice.
I think that's right. And even for those of us maybe who did grow up reading it, in my tradition as a Baptist, that was a normal part of everyday life. We were encouraged to read the Bible every day. But I had such a narrow view of it as a book that was just trying to tell me what to do and how to live, that I too, even though I read it so much, missed out on some of the pleasures of it. And it's not that the Bible isn't trying to tell us what to do or instruct us. It's just that it doesn't always instruct us in the same way that an instruction manual does.
Right. And here's the thing. Who wants to read an instruction manual? You know what I mean? Like, right, that shouldn't exactly. be what our goal is, and it shouldn't be how we're structuring our reading time in the scriptures. I mean, that's what I love so much about this book, is that it seems like the way we're reading scripture is actually harming us, because it's making the scriptures into something they're not and making the whole process dull.
Yeah, and if we look at the example of Jesus Christ, we can see all of these different kinds of instructions. Sometimes, you know, he says very directly, I'm going to do this so that you can see what I'm trying to say. And now pick up your mat and walk. And then other times, you know, someone asks him a question like, who is my neighbor? And he responds not with a direct answer, but by saying, hey, you know, well, there was this man one time and he was walking down the road and he tells this whole story of the Good Samaritan. So sometimes we do need kind of direct instruction.
Yeah.
But in life, things are so complicated that sometimes Jesus himself will give us stories that we really have to work through and sit with and wrestle with in order to understand.
Talk about a contemplative time reading the Bible and what that is to sit and just ponder or to engage.
One of the things that I encourage people to do is to sit down with a passage, especially something from the gospel. I love doing this, especially when Jesus is disrupting things, when he's talking to the religious leaders of his time, and try to sit there, read the passage slowly. You know, don't be in a race to finish, even if you only sit there for 6 minutes. Read it a couple of times and just try to imagine yourself present. Imagine yourself there in the scene and how disruptive and rebellious Jesus is being, and how you would have reacted if you were there, and how the disciples around him or the other religious leaders or onlookers, how they're reacting. Try to imagine that and really put yourself in the scene of Scripture there next to Jesus. That's one of my favorite practices,
yeah,
and really
good.
Trying to slow down.
That's good, Matthew. I appreciate that. I want to just ask about reading the Bible in a way that's different than the theological tradition with which you're familiar. So whatever that is. So if you maybe you are a person who goes to a church that has never appreciated the didactic, you know, approach to the scriptures, and maybe that's a way that you can expand your understanding. Or maybe, like someone from my background who spent so much time reading theology, maybe, you know, expanding what poetry might bring to the table. You know what I mean? Like, speak to people who've only really read the Bible one way.
Yeah, that's such a great question. So yeah, if you've been so conditioned, the first thing is that you're probably not aware that you've been conditioned to read the Bible in one really specific way. So I've seen this a lot when I kind of push against the idea of reading the Bible only as an instruction manual, and people will say, but it is an instruction manual. And I'll say, yes, but it instructs us not just by speaking to our heads, but also by, you know, using this literary language to appeal to our emotions and our desires and our senses. And so what I would say is, if you're used to reading the Bible, you know, more like a work of literature, then try to make really practical application to your life, to not simply ask, well, you know, how is the text tugging at my heart, but also what is it asking me to do? And kind of the reverse, which applies to me and maybe to a lot of listeners, is that if you're mostly used to reading it as an instruction manual that's just telling you information, maybe try to take a time out. And do not simply ask kind of, what does the text that I'm reading mean? But rather ask, you know, how does it mean? What is the text itself doing that is causing me to have this kind of reaction rather than some other reaction? And pay attention to your senses. Pay attention to your emotions.
Right. We get locked into a different, a same way of thinking, of doing. You're trying to shake things up here. You're asking people to look at the Bible, read the Bible, experience the Bible, know the Bible, love the Bible in a way that they have not before.
Coming up.
This ideology is incompatible with the gospel. And as people continue down this road, the divide is going to be catastrophic. We're already beginning to see it. There are going to be some people who end up shipwrecked in their faith because of this.
Vadi Balcom, When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. The social justice movement and critical race theory. Prior to the pandemic and the social upheavals of this past year, these were subjects of a graduate degree program or an activist's dream. Today, they're the driving force behind the Democratic Party, informing the version of reality presented to us by most of our elite media outlets. So how should we respond? Vadi Bakum is the author of Fault Lines, The Social Justice Movement and Evangelicalism's Looming Catastrophe, and soon to be host of a new podcast produced by the Salem Podcast Network, co-hosted by yours truly. He joined my colleague, Eric Metaxas.
How do people get twisted? In other words, we all know if you're a Christian, you're supposed to care about the poor. You're supposed to care about disenfranchised groups. I mean, that's kind of obvious. You're supposed to be anti-racism or tribalism. I mean, that's all basic from the scripture. How does a good idea like that get twisted into what we call social justice that is no longer biblical? What part of social justice, where does it peel away and become something that is dangerous?
You know, ideas have consequences and words have meanings. And we want to be just. We do want to look out for the poor, for the oppressed. And along comes this worldview, this critical theory worldview, that basically says the world is divided into oppressors and the oppressed. It says that the oppressors are white, male, heterosexual, cisgendered, able-bodied, native-born, so on and so forth, on down to Christians, right? It says that, you know, the rest of us are part of these oppressed minority groups. And then it says that justice is about distributing resources and power from the oppressor to the oppressed. So they're using the same words, right? Justice, oppression, you know, so on and so forth. But they're pouring a different meaning into those words.
Okay, let's be honest. We're talking about Marxism. This is cultural Marxism. And instead of wealth redistribution, it's something else redistribution. But it is antithetical to freedom. And most importantly, it's antithetical to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to the Bible.
You're spot on. That's why this is so problematic. That's why it's so confusing and discouraging for many when they see Christians sort of imbibing this, when they see Christians parroting this ideology. I mean, I'm seeing this and it's driving me crazy. I've been talking about cultural Marxism, Gramscian neo-Marxism since, you know, the early to mid 2000s. People looked at me like, you know, what are you on about? What is all that, you know, like I was just making stuff up, you know. And now all of a sudden the enemy is at the gate and people are wondering what happened.
Yeah, the enemy's inside the gate in many of our churches. I mean, it's just astonishing to me, you know, the idea that many evangelicals, usually, let's be honest, white evangelicals, the whiter, the more likely they are to feel, I guess, maybe some sense of white guilt that prevents them from caring about why these are bad issues. All they could see is, I'm white, I got to do something, yes, I have privilege. They don't really seem to be able to think more deeply about the fact that people in the church should always be for equality and against racism. How do they make that leap? In other words, when did it leap to critical race theory, you know?
Yeah. And critical race theory, you know, comes out of critical theory. But to go back to what you were saying, Christians are for equality. But critical theory is not about equality. Critical theory is about equity. It's a Marxist concept. Equity is about equal outcomes. Equity is about equal distribution. And so when Christians say, yes, we're all about justice, we're all about equality, again, they're speaking a different language and not realizing that these ideas come from somewhere. And most of the time they come from the academy, and many people aren't sort of accustomed to talking about it from that perspective. But the academy is using it in these deceptive ways intentionally because they know that that's the way that you get into people's thinking. This is not going to end well. We're seeing the divide. We're seeing the divide in churches and families and denominations and so on and so forth. This ideology is incompatible with the gospel. And as people continue down this road, the divide is going to be catastrophic. We're already beginning to see it. There are going to be some people who end up shipwrecked in their faith because of this.
What strikes me as troubling is that Marxism is by definition anti-God. It's enforced atheism. It's a godless philosophy by definition. But people who are trying to push it, they don't really want to talk about that. They don't want to lead with that because they don't want to drive people away. So BLM has made great inroads. But when you push God out of the picture, you get this kind of ideology. Anything we know by definition, if it's pushed God out of the picture, there is something satanic about it.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And not only did Marx have this open animosity toward religion in general and Christianity in particular, but also Gramsci. Gramsci talks about socialism being that ideology that must most assuredly supplant Christianity. There's open hostility today in grievance studies, in the sort of social justice literature towards Christianity. Christianity is seen as an oppressive hegemony. Again, these things are not new, and it is surprising until you recognize that this deception is intentional. When you talk about people being delivered from oppression, when you talk about, you know, equity, which sounds a lot like equality, and when you talk about, you know, resources being fairly distributed, these are things that sound good to Christians. They sound good to Americans. And unless you scratch and go beneath the surface, you can be duped. And many people are duped into believing that this is okay. Or what they do is they'll say, well, I know that ideology is not okay, but what they're going for, right, or the Christian version of what they're going for is okay, and what we'll do is we'll ride that ideology in order to get the Christian version of what they're going for, and there is no middle way with this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Christian version of atheism. Let's try it. It really is a utopianist scheme. I mean, we can think of the Tower of Babel. We want to get to heaven without God. We're going to do it on our own. I would say, philosophically, that's ultimately the project beneath what we're talking about. We know that it cannot succeed, but many people seem to think that it can. Many Christians seem to think that it can.
Yeah, and in many ways, it's an overrealized eschatology, right? We have a natural hunger and thirst and desire for that time when God will make all things right, when we'll be delivered from this, you know, the pain of this world and from the yearnings and longings of this world in that perfect world that is to come. And in many cases, what happens is people are tapping into that and offering it as though we can have it, number one, in the here and now, and number two, without God.
Coming up,
this is a huge slap to the Biden administration.
In the final segment of the Christian Outlook, stay with us. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Ever since the appointments of Justice Kavanaugh and then Justice Amy Coney Barrett, we've been told that the court is hopelessly divided. We've been led to believe that it's so divided that it can no longer function effectively as the nation's highest court. President Biden has even talked of adding seats to the court or packing the court, inspired by the efforts of President Roosevelt prior to World War II, something that backfired. But the message from the court itself doesn't seem to match the message I've just described. Here's Bob Burney from WRFD, The Word, in Columbus, Ohio.
We have had a whole string of unanimous 9-0 decisions from this court. And here's one from yesterday. Let me read from the news release, Dateline, Washington, D.C. A unanimous Supreme Court ruled yesterday that thousands of people who entered the country illegally but have been allowed to stay for humanitarian reasons are ineligible to apply to become permanent residents. Justice Elena Kagan wrote for the court that federal immigration law prohibits people who entered the country illegally and now have temporary protected status from seeking green cards to remain in the country permanently. Yeah, this is a huge slap to the Biden administration. This is exactly the opposite of what the Biden administration wanted. And I am shocked that a unanimous decision from this Supreme Court would say, no, if you came to this country illegally, you can't become a citizen. Good for the Supreme Court. These people are here under what's called the TPS, the Temporary Protected Status. The outcome in the case involves a couple from El Salvador who have been in the U.S. since the early 1990s, turned on whether people who entered the country illegally and were given humanitarian protections were ever admitted into the United States under immigration law. Kagan wrote they were not. Quote, the TPS, that's the Temporary Protected Status, the TPS program gives foreign nationals non-immigrant status, but it does not admit them. So the conferral of TPS does not make an unlawful entrant eligible for a green card. Good for the Supreme Court. Hey, I am for immigration. I mean, let's face it, all of our ancestors were immigrants, all of them. We are all descendants from immigrants to the United States. So I think we should all be sympathetic to immigration as long as it is legal.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about our program. Send them to ChristianOutlook.com to subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Pulsayan and Nicholas Malone, I'm Kevin McCullough. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
When she was just a girl, she expected the world.